It's Thursday, December 16, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Today begins with a major winter storm affecting much of the country, certainly in the Midwest, also in some other regions as well, interrupting some holiday plans. But it's not the cold that's so much the story in Washington, D.C., but the heat of controversy. In this lame duck Congress, and remember that lame duck Congress is almost always somewhat awkward, what we find are now the House of Representatives and the Senate responding to each other with a battle of the bills. The House of Representatives is sending to the Senate a bill, a standalone bill, that would repeal the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. The Senate, on the other hand, is sending to the House of Representatives the budget and tax compromise that was negotiated between Senate Republicans and President Barack Obama. The House of Representatives is likely to tamper with the bill. The compromise that was effected between Senate Republicans and President Obama is anathema to several members of the House. And at this point, remember, the Democrats in this lame duck session are continuing their control of the House and of its process. But in the Senate, it is unlikely that the don't ask, don't tell policy is going to fare much better. But the key issue is the vote that would allow the bill to come to the floor for discussion. That requires 60 votes. And at least some believe that those who are pushing for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell have the 60 votes. We'll find out in very short order. Wednesday's edition of the Wall Street Journal has a very interesting column by Douglas Murray. It has to do with terror, the United Kingdom's new Christmas export. Now, if you're tracing the history of the radicalization of Islam in our times, it's almost impossible not to put London and other major British cities right at the center of this particular effort. The radicalization of many Islamic young men seems to be taking place even as Britons are educating them, treating them medically through their health service, and incorporating them throughout British culture. Now, the point made by Mr. Murray comes down to this. Britain has something to answer for here because they have allowed radicalized terrorists to appear in terms of speaking circuits on British university campuses for some time. I read from Mr. Murray's article. He writes that extremist speakers appear unchallenged every week at British universities. These speakers have advocated suicide bombings, the murder of soldiers and innocent civilians, and the persecution of religious and sexual minorities in Britain. He also points out that one of these speakers was Anwar al-Awlaki, now the subject of a kill or capture order from President Barack Obama. Awlaki was, until last year, an invited favorite at British universities' Islamic societies. It should then come as little surprise that some of the young men, indeed several of the young men, who have been involved in terrorist attacks both in Britain and in other parts of the world, were indeed British university students who were apparently radicalized right under the noses of British authorities. Of similar concern, French philosopher Pascal Bruckner writes in the journal Liberation that criticizing Islam should not be considered Islamophobia. As he argues, Islamic fundamentalists aim to make Islam an untouchable subject. This is rooted back at least to the 1970s, when it was an Iranian fundamentalist who coined the term Islamophobia. Mr. Bruckner writes, "A faith is not a race. It's a school of thought, and debating its merits should not be a thought crime." And here is a very important point raised by this French philosopher. He says that we must maintain the right to say that a religion is wrong. It must not be considered a thought crime to say so. Now, Christians looking at that may wince a bit, but that's exactly true. Freedom of speech and freedom of religion absolutely require the ability not only to say what we believe is true, but to say what we believe is false. Mr. Bruckner also makes several other points. He traces the history of Europe in terms of this Islamic threat and the threat of radicalization, and he suggests that the use of a term like Islamophobia is indeed just an effort to intimidate. He also says, let's not forget that of all the monotheistic religions, it is Christianity that is currently the most persecuted. Christians can't worship openly in many Muslim countries. In Iraq, they're even being killed for their faith. Yet nobody complains of Christianophobia. Here's an interesting thought experiment for you. Try to imagine a majority Christian country where Muslims are not basically completely free to enjoy religious liberty. But on the other hand, try to imagine a majority Muslim country where Christians are actually given the same right and true religious freedom. Do you sometimes feel that someone's playing with you in terms of price strategies and sales and discounts? Well, in its personal journal section in Wednesday's edition, the Wall Street Journal suggests that many Americans can't keep track and actually are very poor at determining For example, which discount is actually better? Is the discount better if an item is discounted 20% and then another 20% and then another 20% or simply 50%? By the way, the answer is, of course, 50%. Taking 20% off three different times in terms of the discounted price does not actually eventuate in the same savings as 50% off up front. There's a lot of psychology in this salesmanship, and I found one point very interesting. Year by year, it seems to differ as to whether Americans are more likely to buy something that is buy one, get one free, or something that is 50% off. Now, you can do the math and determine that that's exactly the same discount. But people do not always buy according to the same mathematical formula. Year by year, Americans seem to prefer buy one, get one free one year and 50% off on another year. The merchandisers are always just trying to figure out which year it is. This all tells us something about human nature, of course. These stores are raising their prices in order to offer deeper discounts. That's just the way the game is played. It's the way the rationalization of sales and buying decisions are made. And it reminds us that we are not the cold-blooded analytical creatures we sometimes think ourselves to be as consumers. We are driven by all kinds of impulses, by emotions, by certain aspirations. And who knows whether we actually even know sometimes why we are more likely to buy at 50% off or buy one, get one free. I don't want to leave unnoted a major article that appeared this week in the New York Times. The headline is Bold Crossings of the Gender Line. William Van Meter reports that even leading Hollywood celebrities have decided that it's all right to do some gender bending. This is what he writes. It's certainly a statement of our times that, in the same month, James Franco graces the covers of GQ, that's Gentleman's Quarterly, and Candy. In GQ, he appears in a moody headshot. In Candy, a style magazine dedicated to what it calls the transversal, that is, transsexuality, transvestitism, cross-dressing, androgyny, and any combination thereof, Mr. Franco appears in a towel-applied makeup, heavy jewelry, and a woman's dominatrix-style power suit. End quote. He goes on to write, Candy, it turns out, is but one of the more visible bits of evidence that the year 2010 will be remembered as the year of the transsexual. Now, James Franco here becomes an example of what's going on in the gender bending of the larger society. As Mr. Van Meter points out, other celebrities have flirted with what is hinted at as the other side, which means at least cross-dressing for fashion publications. Not since the glam era of the 1970s, he writes, has gender bending so saturated the news media. The difference now is that mystery has been replaced with empowerment and even pride. Here are but a few of the gender-bending highlights of the year 2010 cited in this article. In November, a transgender student pledged a sorority at Trinity University in Texas. Original Plumbing, that is a magazine for trans guys, came out with a fashion issue. This month, Simon & Schuster will publish a book entitled My Princess Boy, a children's book about a boy who wears pink gowns. There is a good deal more mentioned in the article, but let's pause just to consider this. Christians are marked for the fact that our worldview has as one very central element the fact that the Creator made us as male and female, that gender is a part of the goodness of God's creation, and that indeed tampering with these things is a way of denying God His glory and a way of confusing humanity and minimizing and harming human flourishing. People who are involved in these kind of gender-bending exercises say they're doing so in order to achieve some sort of liberation. But gender, that is our sex assignment, is not something from which we are supposed to be liberated. That's the wrong category to be used here. Now just consider the claim that 2010 is going to be the year of the trans, transsexual, transvestites, transgender, trans-whatever, and androgyny. You add it all up and it does amount to something of a cultural signal in our times. I want to address an issue that came to me just in recent days. A writer complained about my use of the word gender. It was a mild rebuke, but the person was saying we ought to keep the old word sex. Well, that raises a host of issues, but it's virtually impossible to avoid using the word gender these days, and for multiple reasons. For one of them is, the language has shifted on the issue, and the word sex is simply dominating with other meanings. It's very difficult to use the word sex when you mean male or female, because you have to couch it in so many conditioned terms, there simply isn't enough space. There's another reason, too, and this is, quite frankly, another sign of the times. I avoid using the word sex when I'm really talking about what is now discussed as gender, because filtering systems can simply block an article when I'm not even talking about what they're trying to filter out. That, too, is a sign of the times. The use of the word gender can be very slippery and is ideologically charged. But in order to enter into this ideological argument, sometimes we have to use the terms that are available to us in order to make the point we feel desperately, urgently important to make. Two signs of the times in our culture to note today. First of all, I hold in my hand the very last printed issue of U.S. News and World Report. I grew up with this magazine. As a matter of fact, it was the news magazine of the three big ones, that is Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report, that was received by my parents in our home. I devoured it week by week. Now, I hold the very last print issue. The editor's note on the front says this: "We are writing to inform you that this will be your last issue of U.S. News and World Report magazine. The U.S. News and World Report will no longer be published as either a monthly, print, or digital replica magazine. U.S. News Media Group will continue to publish the usnews.com website and many other products." Well, that's a big change. But an even bigger change in terms of my reading of the culture takes place tonight at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, when Larry King will air his very last program on CNN. Larry King has been a fixture not only on CNN, but in American culture for a number of years. Reaching back to his early radio days, this will mark tonight about 50,000 interviews that he has done over the course of a very loquacious lifetime. Bill Carter and Brian Stelter, writing in the New York Times, point out that when Mr. King ends his run in the 9 o'clock hour on CNN tonight, he will do so having run through several different epochs of American history. Now, there have been all kinds of critiques of Larry King. After all, he does seem to have the ability to talk to just about anyone at any time and to have a celebrity one day and a solid news story the next. He is certainly drawn to celebrities, no question about that. He's been charged with asking basically softball questions, but several of the people in this article responded by defending Mr. King, pointing out that his so-called softball questions were often a way of allowing the guest rather than the interviewer to speak. Mr. King himself lamented that in the course of his lifetime, the interviewers had gone from interviewing guests to largely interviewing themselves. I have to leave with a word of personal appreciation and tribute. I had the opportunity to be on the Larry King Show over 40 times. I was interviewed left and right, and sometimes not with softball questions by any measure, by Mr. King. He gave me a lot of opportunity. I enjoyed the opportunity of conversing with him and through him with so many other guests on that program. I, too, was puzzled by how Mr. King could go from one issue to another with the seemingly same sense of gravity and importance. But he did deal with many important issues, and when the news broke on CNN, it was so often Larry King who was there. It was an honor to join him so many times on his program, and I offer my most sincere congratulations to Larry King as he marks his retirement. My wife Mary and I grew up in South Florida as teenagers, where we heard Larry King back in the 1970s as a local radio celebrity. Little did we know that he would end up on CNN. Little did I know that I would so often end up on CNN with him. I feel the need to say that he was always a warm and gracious human being who seemed genuinely interested, not only in the conversation, but with the persons with whom he was talking. He was always gracious, but at times he was clearly shocked by what some of us had to say. Congratulations, Mr. King. We're going to miss you. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I want you to know about a very special opportunity coming next year. My wife Mary and I are going to be joining friends for an Alaskan cruise that is scheduled from July 30 to August 6th of 2011. Through a partnership with Inspiration Cruises and Tours, we're going to be taking this tour of Alaska, which is intended to be both a vacation and a journey of learning, adventure, and Christian fellowship. The 7-day cruise will depart from and conclude in Seattle, Washington. It includes stops in Juneau and Sitka, Alaska, as well as at the Hubbard Glacier and in Victoria, British Columbia. I've always wanted to visit Alaska. Mary and I are looking forward to a very special event next summer when we, along with so many friends at Southern Seminary, will cruise the glacier-ridden waters of Alaska and see one of the most beautiful regions on Earth. I'm also looking to the special times of fellowship and deep times of Bible study. For more information, email me at mail@albertmoeller.com. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. To follow me on Twitter, go to twitter.com/AlbertMoeller. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.